A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know. The law is reason free from passion. Does anyone know who spoke those immortal words?
This is Two J's in a Pod. The J stands for journalist. I'm Mary Ellen Murphy with WGHN Radio.
And I'm Sarah Leach from the Ottawa News Network.
This is a special podcast because we have a special guest in the studio.
Hi, I'm Sarah Riley Howard. So happy to be here. Thank you.
The lawyer that sued the county.
Yes, yes. So many times.
Yeah. I can't believe that you're in
our
studios.
That is what I'm known as now. So. For better or for worse.
I was thinking about you on the way in because I used to say to my one daughter, you should just go to law school because I can't. She would, anything she wanted to do, she would have a document. This is why you need to let me do this. She won every argument we ever had. I'm like, you need to go to law school. Anyway.
Did she?
No, she did not. Nope. She went into teaching and now maybe she will now. Now she's a stay-at-home mom, but maybe she eventually will. How long have you been a lawyer?
Oh, goodness. I have been a lawyer for almost 23 years.
Okay. And did you always know you wanted to do that?
I was fairly certain I wanted to do that. Ironically, I never thought I would actually practice. I thought I would go to law school and have a law degree and then go into politics or public policy or do something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I knew I would have to work as a lawyer for a while to pay for it. And then I discovered I really liked being a lawyer. So here we are.
Uh-huh. Didn't you tell me once that you considered going into journalism?
I think it was a very serious career choice.
Really?
Actually, I was hoping to go to MSU so I could study journalism there. I grew up in Mount Pleasant, so no way I was going to CMU, even though it's a lovely place.
Right.
So yeah. But then I decided to go to law school instead, and here we are. But I've worked at several newspapers over the years.
I didn't know that about you. Wow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something?
I know, right?
I was thinking about you, and I was thinking about Adeline Hambly. I've been thinking about her, because we knew that we were going to have you in the studio as a special guest, and I was thinking, who walks away from a $4 million lawsuit? That just speaks to her character, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, it's now that it's all over, I think that is the optic. But it was a lot more complicated than that. Right, Sarah?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. You know, it was pretty hard to accept the $4 million, as you might find it difficult to believe. But
Well, yeah. What would that say about her?
Well, she wanted to stay, right?
Yeah.
That was the whole point of doing this. And they were so determined to see her out. And you don't know what's going to happen in litigation. You don't know what judges will decide or how the law will come down.
I see.
And there's always risk. And so we thought about what would make the biggest statement in the end. And it certainly made a statement, although not the one anyone expected, I suppose.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, we were both, I would say, not even elated after she decided it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I remember.
Which is hard to, for people to fathom, I would suppose.
But, it is. I get it.
That was a down day, because I remember talking I didn't talk to Adeline that day, but I talked to Marcia Mansouri.
Okay.
And yeah, it was very subdued. That was definitely the vibe.
Wow.
But then everything changed.
Right. So, after that, it became clear that everyone understood that the commission majority at the time was really willing to do get her out by all means necessary, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that really did not sit well with people, which I completely understand. As
right.
a taxpayer, it was infuriating and hard to believe, right? You
right.
just could not believe that was a thing they were willing to
right.
do.
Right, right.
So it all came out in the end, as it turns out. So She ended up with more protections than she had when they first tried to oust her. And while I regret as a taxpayer that they had to pay the amount of attorney fees they had to, I think it's that type of pain is the only type of disincentive that they understand. So,
right.
You know, could have settled it months earlier for less than half the price, as people will remember. So,
but isn't it my understanding that some of them are still denying that there was a $4 million offer?
For sure. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's been the line that Moss has been peddling for,
still.
I mean, always, almost from Jump Street. I think that once they realized that the deal was unenforceable from there, and even before, they had sort of addressed it, tried to withdraw it. You know, Sarah and Adeline had to try to get that agreement enforced in court. I think that they knew that they were in trouble, and so. Isn't that what the only thing that left to do is just to deny that it ever happened, because we'll prove that it did happen. It's easy to discredit when you just sort of deny and deflect. It's a tactic.
And hide behind a closed meeting.
So. Right.
Right. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. But one thing that I wanted to ask you is, what has inspired you to get involved with all of the cases that you have brought? What keeps you kind of like motivated to keep doing this? I mean, is it something that you do you feel like it's the right thing to do? I mean, do you feel like it's a civic duty at a certain point, because you're also taking on a lot of risk by filing these cases and not really knowing for sure the outcome?
That is a good question. I decided a while ago when I chose to become a civil rights attorney that this was what I wanted to do, and part of this job involves, on maybe a less notorious scale, but the types of decisions I've made getting into some of the cases in Ottawa County that I have. So I was already sort of used to that calculus when this started. But I felt compelled to do this with my career, and here I am living in the midst of a situation that feels very much like there is something I can do here with what everyone else is doing to say this is not the kind of government we want and not the kind of place we want to live. And so it's hard to do anything but jump in with the experience I've gained about how you do something about that situation. It would have been hard for me not to do it, I guess. So,
yeah.
Yeah, honestly, that's kind of how I felt when I lost my job last year, and I could have stopped, but I
you could have set up camp anywhere.
I know. It's like
take your laptop.
It was something that I could do, and I felt compelled to do it.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
And well, I think the podcast is the reason why, you know, you and I decided to do this. We want to tell the story about what's happening. I can't do that in a 4-minute newscast. It's not going to happen. My news on Friday was all weather. It was all weather related. Yeah. I mean, things get pushed back when there are, you know. And so to tell the story of everything that's been happening in Ottawa County with the Board of Commissioners, you have to do a podcast. It's right. The only way to talk about what's happening. It can't get covered in a newscast.
Right.
It can maybe in a print story. It can. That's a little different. But people, after about three minutes, 30 seconds, people kind of tune out of the news. That's what we've been told anyway.
Right.
On the radio.
So. Sad but true. Although I will say that I was at the Michigan Press Association convention last week. And
she got some fabulous award, I hear.
Stop.
You never want to talk about it.
No, don't look at me. Don't listen to me.
I know. That's why I hide my microphone every day.
I'm very, self-deprecating. but one of the things that I was asked on a panel is that what kind of advice would you give to some of the younger students kind of coming up in the ranks? Mm-hmm. And I said, I honestly think that I have found a niche in long form narrative journalism, which is sort of counterintuitive to what everything has evolved into being. You know, these like catchy headlines, and you have to compartmentalize stories because everybody has the attention span of a fruit fly. And I'm not doing that. I mean, I'm doing like these big, meaty, you know, very in-depth, like all the background you're ever going to need. And people seem to react to it. Maybe it's because of the subject matter. Maybe it's because it's controversial. I guess that's possible, but I think that people still appreciate that in the news diet that they have. Mm-hmm. I think they miss it.
I wonder if the younger generation has the patience to read that, though, to read something
well,
like that.
Well, if they don't, then we're doomed.
Well, that's what I'm saying. that's what I'm saying.
I have to believe that some
of them
will get
it. My own daughter doesn't listen to my radio show. They don't...
That
you
could
know?
Just be a mother-daughter thing.
Yeah, probably.
I know my kids are like, you're not that big of a deal, Mom. And I know.
It's not that fun coming to the radio station anymore. Although the grandkids love to come here and touch everything and, you know, that kind of thing. But
the buttons alone, I think.
Oh, yeah. So how many lawsuits do we have right now?
Still active? Three. Yeah.
Three lawsuits are active
I'd
right
like
now.
To say two and a half.
Okay, so clarify. Two and a half. Go ahead. What do you mean, two and a half?
Well, there's two against the county Board of Commissioners, and then there's one that involves one commissioner.
Fair, yes.
Okay. And that commissioner is?
Mr. Moss.
All right. And that is the Chris Kleinian's lawsuit?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. What would you like to talk about?
Everything.
Well, one of the things that I am curious about is that this is unique in that it's sort of a multi-pronged defendant situation.
Yes.
And that's different from the other suits that we've seen. So how do you tackle sort of, you know, negotiating with two very diametrically opposed sides because they're not necessarily coordinating together either?
True. I've had cases like this before where we have two defendants for whatever reason. This one is a unique one, though, I will say that. It's interesting because we're in the middle of discovery right now. And for those who aren't as familiar with the litigation process, discovery is the period of time that the court gives us to collect evidence. And so, and we can compel people to provide us information. So I can send written discovery requests to the other parties and they have to answer them or have valid objections. And they did the same to us. And now we're in the stage where we take depositions. So we make people come and give sworn testimony in a conference room with a court reporter, like you would see in a courthouse.
Okay.
and we're in the midst of taking the depositions of people who have potentially relevant information in the case.
Okay.
When that period of time is all over, then there will be various motions and things, but we will slowly proceed toward trial. Now, of course, as I'm sure you know, like the stats are something like less than 0.5% of all cases go to trial.
Right.
So the chances that any of these do are slim. They usually get resolved in some other way. And the court has a number of stages at which they try and encourage us toward settlement. So mm-hmm. we've had one settlement conference already with the magistrate judge. We have another one scheduled at the end of June.
Okay.
And you're negotiating with both sides simultaneously during
Correct.
Those.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like what you're picturing, though. It's a lot less exciting. It's not like us around a table with, like, fist pounding or anything.
right.
And not a dollar more.
Yeah. They put us in separate rooms, and the judge goes from room to room working as a mediator to try to get us in agreement.
Okay.
And it is certainly more complicated when you have a second defendant because they might have interests that don't align.
Right.
One of them may not want to settle if the other one's still in it or vice versa. Because, for example, if we were to settle with MSU but not with Mr. Moss, if this were to go further and if there were to be further hearings or a trial, MSU's parties can still be subpoenaed to come testify. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's... All of those things are complicating to reaching a potential settlement. But we're still, I'm getting a little bit down the road for us, we're still in the midst of collecting discovery and taking sworn testimony.
So and this all started because, let's for those just tuning in, the lawsuit.
Yeah, so this, once upon a time. so in 2023, the County Board of Commissioners approved its budget, its annual budget, in October. Mm-hmm. And those paying attention will probably remember that that was the budget when the health department funding also got deep cuts affected. So in November, There is an annual contract that the county has with the MSU Extension Office, because it's a mutual agreement where the county provides a certain amount of administrative support. There's some office space. I think that they cover the funding for the 4-H director, if I'm not mistaken. It was supposed to be renewed at the time that the budget cycle was supposed to be approved, which is in October. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. And so MSU started to ask some questions about, hey, you know, what's the status of everything? And at the time, John Gibbs was our county administrator, and there was not really much response. And then there's a meeting between Joe Moss and Commissioner Allison Miedema, and they're both members of OI, and they meet with MSU administrators, and they essentially say, well, you have this person that is running for county commissioner, and we think that that is a conflict for him to hold that employment position with you while he's running for office. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the MSU kind of says, well, we're not going to fire him because he has every right to run for office. So there are emails that attest to these conversations mm-hmm. that happen. And then former Commissioner Chris Kleinians is the employee. He does get elected in a special election, because that was when Lucy Ebel was recalled.
Right.
He defeated her. He comes into office, and within 3 weeks, he's notified by MSU that he cannot no longer work there, which, according to him, completely blindsides him, because he was never informed that that was a potential outcome for seeking public office. Mm-hmm. So that is where the conflict is. And so, you know, he retains Sarah and they file suit. But Moss wasn't actually added to the lawsuit until much later, because there is a hearing in Lansing that summer. And while testimony is taken from the MSU administrators at the time, there were two that testified. They essentially admitted that Moss put pressure on them. If you don't resolve this issue to my satisfaction, basically, mm-hmm. then I'm not going to approve your contract.
Wow.
So then he was added as a co-defendant.
Okay, here you go. Okay.
Right. So MSU's position back at that hearing for a preliminary injunction at the beginning of the case was that, yes, Chairman Moss tried to pressure us, mm-hmm. But we didn't capitulate. We said, no, he has every right to run, and we left him in his employment. And it's only because we got legal advice that he could not keep his seat as a county commissioner and continue to work for MSU Extension under the Incompatible Offices Act that we decided he had to make a choice. And if he wouldn't leave his commission seat or voluntarily take a leave of absence, he was going to have to be fired. So their position is that's the difference, and that's why they had to do it. Our position is the Incompatible Offices Act absolutely does not care if an employee of MSU Extension also sits on the commission. The only mm-hmm. thing he would have to do, for example, is he would have to recuse himself or declare a conflict if they were, for example, voting to renew the MSU Extension contract.
Okay.
But without there being a direct conflict like that, that's the only thing he would need to do, is our position. And so we are currently arguing about that state of affairs. Mm-hmm. So we're in the discovery gathering process, taking the depositions of witnesses to the case and reviewing all the documents, which is super interesting to go back and see all of these emails that were exchanged.
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you can talk about, or is that not appropriate?
Yeah. I can talk about it. We have no protective order, with the exception of a few things which aren't relevant here. I mean, there are, it's clear there was a lot of discussion happening about Chris and his activities in the county, and then MSU did, as we all know now, basically send back a communication to Mr. Moss and Ms. Miedema and said, you know, look, we respect Mr. Kleinians' First Amendment rights, and we're not going to move him out of Ottawa County or do anything else. They did tell them that when he was running.
When he was running, right.
Okay.
So, which I have to imagine didn't sit well. But
is there an absence of any evidence that MSU was communicating with amongst themselves that they had informed Chris that he would be fired if he did win?
Well, thank you for that softball, Sarah. Yes, there are.
Because that's what I'm guessing is probably the case, because that's what happened at the hearing, is that they couldn't produce any. They couldn't confirm if or when. Well, they said they did, but they couldn't say when during the hearing. And I thought that that was a little odd.
Right. So the position we're all in right now is that MSU says we told him early on that if he won, this was the consequence. Mm-hmm. Our position is, no, you didn't. We would have remembered that.
And I would think so.
Commissioner, while an important position, does not make very much every right. year, and it was not going to replace Chris's job. And that would have been, I'm sure, a pretty serious conversation between Mr. and Mrs. Kleinjans had that been raised.
Right.
So, there's nothing in writing. So MSU concedes we did not tell him that in writing. And
you'd think that they would, considering that that is, you
know. And they say a lot of things in writing. So, yeah. You know, so that's where things stand. Their witnesses are sure they told him.
Okay.
We're sure they didn't. And they say, well, regardless, it was still our legal obligation to say we can't continue to employ him if he's going to sit on the county commission.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we get to part two of this saga in discovery, which is there is a doctrine that allows, so as most people know, communications that you have with your attorney are covered by attorney-client privilege, mm-hmm. so that you have the opportunity to get advice, speak freely, and come up with strategy unencumbered by that being discovered by the other side in a litigation case. It is a sacrosanct principle of the law. However, in cases like this one, where the defense is based on the advice of counsel, so they're saying, look, we got advice from our lawyers, we had to fire him. The law, in my view, the law says you don't get to rest on that and say, well, our lawyers told us we had to fire him, but what they told us is secret. So you don't get to probe into
right.
that or find out anything
right.
about it mm-hmm. or know how definite they were
right.
or was that the advice they even gave.
It's yeah, because if they're going to use it as their defense, it's subject to scrutiny.
Right. If they're going to use it as their defense, mm-hmm. we get to look behind
you
it.
You get to look behind it, yeah.
As in, you know, most lawyers, when asked to waive the privilege, though, put up somewhat of a understandable fuss about that. So we are making a motion to the judge asking for them to be ordered to turn over this privileged information. And what's strange in the Western District of Michigan, the federal court that we're in, is there's a local court rule that requires that you tell the other side that you're going to file this motion that they will find very offensive, you know, and see if they will agree to it. And see if they will agree to it, which is always
which never awkward. Happens, probably.
No, no. It's a very awkward conversation, but everybody understands why you're having it, because the court rule requires that you go to them and see, can we work something out?
Okay.
Is really the larger point of why we're doing, you know, can we agree that you're going to give me half of this stuff or not all of it or whatever? And I've had multiple conversations with the lawyer for MSU about this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't agree, so we're filing this motion. So this will not come as a surprise to him, as we have talked about it ad nauseum. So,
okay.
But it's an interesting legal issue, to be sure, one you don't get very often. I think this might only be the second case I've ever had where this has come up. So.
Wow. Yeah. You must work 80 hours a week plus.
If you were to ask my children, I'm sure they would say that, but it's hard to say. It's hard
yeah.
to say.
Yeah, it is with me too, because sometimes if I'm at home, there might be something that I'll get an email and I'll be, oh, I got time to work on. You know, you just.
Sometimes I sit on the couch and I'm you know, answering emails or, you know, typing up a little brief or a story or something, but I'm sitting with the kids, and I count that as family time. They do not.
Yeah, there you go. Wow.
Well, what about you want to move on to we got two other lawsuits to talk about.
Yeah, let's talk.
What about the FOIA lawsuit? Because I just from based on, you know, my Sentinel days, I find this fascinating for lots of different reasons. But where are we with that particular case?
Well, when we last left our heroes, they had two citizens filed a FOIA request
right.
filed two different FOIA requests.
Right, at different times, yeah.
And in fact, unrelated FOIA requests. And people brought this issue to me multiple times over the course of Ottawa Impact's time in the majority, but there was never the right time to bring up this issue in litigation for one reason or another. But the county took the position repeatedly, I know, because people asked me about it, throughout the time of the Ottawa Impact majority, that commissioners could not be compelled to produce information in their personal communication accounts, so personal email, personal messenger accounts, or from their personal devices. I believe this is not consistent with what the Freedom of Information Act requires.
Well, and wasn't this like settled in a, there's some sort of legal precedent, but you were trying to explain to me about whether or not opinions are published and whether or not judges can consider them?
Yes. So there is a case on this that says your private accounts and private devices, if you're a public official, absolutely are subject to FOIA if you're talking about public business. Mm-hmm. However, that case is unpublished currently. It used to be when cases were published in books, that distinction made a lot more sense because either it made it into the, it was important enough to make it into the bound volume. Like when you see pictures of lawyers' offices and there's all those beautiful leather volumes, that's what they
yeah.
are.
Yeah.
However, they still do that, I'm told, but nobody keeps the books anymore. It's all electronic. Like you subscribe to a service, you pay for it, and so in reality, it's all published because it's published electronically.
So okay, you can see it. Yeah,
and see it. And so, but they still have that distinction of is this a case, an opinion's declared published by the court because it's sufficiently important. Talks about a new area of the law or whatever, or it's unpublished. And under the court rules in Michigan, an unpublished case is technically not binding precedent. It can be persuasive to the court, but the court's not required to follow it. And that's the only really, truly on point decision, in my view, that we have so far. We have a couple of other issues in this case that the defense has raised, like whether or not these county commissioners, the chair of the Compensation Commission, whether they are public officials for purposes of FOIA, given the definition of what a public official is. I mean, if they're not public officials for purposes of FOIA, the legislature ought to go back into session today to amend that, in my view. But our position is there is a Michigan Supreme Court case on point which says that they are. So that's another dispute that we have about whether or not they're covered.
But, right.
So we filed this case with two different FOIA requests by two different citizens and said, you know, the reason they were both rejected was that they weren't going to look in officials' private devices. And we said, that's not what the law is. And then here we are in litigation. The plot thickens, however, because we have multiple public officials' communications were requested. And they, some of them are still in office. Some of them are no longer in office,
right.
given how long the case has gone on.
Yeah.
And the county said, well, what is our obligation? What if they won't answer us? You know, can we be, you can't do anything to us and we can't make them answer, which I feel like is, in any event.
If it was made during the time when they were public officials and the requests were legally made, doesn't that sort of defeat that argument?
In my view, it does.
Okay.
And the judge said, go and ask them if they have responsive communications and come back and report.
Okay.
And the county came back and reported that they had talked to about half of the officials, some current, some former, who all said they had nothing. And then they said they could not get a hold of four of the officials at issue. Three were former commissioners Terpstra, Ebel, and Belknap. And one was the chair of the Compensation Commission, Lynn Jansen. And I said, I don't think the county's tried hard enough to find them, and I would like to take some discovery and take their deposition and find out what their answer is, and, you know, will they... Can I compel them to come testify if they won't answer the county? So we're in the middle of taking some depositions right now. We've taken one so far, and we have three upcoming of the four people that the county did not get a hold of.
Okay. Anything interesting take place in that deposition?
Yes. So I took the deposition of one of the former commissioners this week, and it appears to me that the county may have, at least with respect to some of them, used their county-issued cell numbers to try and get a hold of them, which they had to turn those in when they were no longer county commissioners. So it is not surprising that they, you know, got a disconnected number message, or because those numbers are no longer in service.
Right.
And these individuals were not super difficult to look to track down. Right. This is, for the size of this county, it's still a small town.
It is. Right. It is. Yeah.
So, they're all still here.
It was not difficult to track down any of these individuals.
Okay.
You know, and serve subpoenas. We have served all but one with a subpoena.
Okay.
So far, and I'm confident we will serve the last one with a subpoena. And so our position is, well, if they didn't want to answer you, then they have to answer a subpoena, and we'll ask them if they have any information. And so far we have one document that was produced in this last deposition that we didn't have before, that we take the position should have been turned over pursuant to FOIA. I know that's not the county's position, but that's where we are.
Is that because one of the recipient on the other end of that communication is one of the other commissioners?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
That would do
it. Okay, that would do it. Wow.
When you take a deposition, legally, isn't that a little bit of a risk for the other side? Because you can ask a sort of beyond what the case is applicable to, right? You have a little bit of leeway in terms of asking some probing questions, as long as you can tie it into the, you know, the thrust of what the lawsuit is actually about.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the law says you're allowed to ask about things that are relevant, which there's a pretty wide definition to what's relevant. And we're given some leeway in terms of when you're looking for evidence, you don't know exactly what's out there. So you might ask things that don't turn out to be relevant, but you don't know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and it's generally speaking, there are only a few grounds on which a lawyer can instruct their client or their witness not to answer in a deposition. And most of the time you're supposed to, you can object.
Right.
And say, I object to this. I don't think it should ever be used in a court, but then the witness still has to answer.
What if they refuse?
Well, that's interesting, because that is also an issue we've run into in this case, where there's been the refusal to testify. And so I, again, not a surprise to the other side, because I've had to raise the topic with them, but we're making a motion to compel to reopen their deposition and ask the court to find that they have to testify about this information they didn't want to talk about that we think is clearly relevant to the case.
Yeah, I've never been deposed, I've never seen a deposition, but I'm sure that you've done this enough times where you feel like you're getting truthful answers and sometimes not so truthful answers. What do you do when you feel like someone is not being genuine in their responses to you? Like, do you have any recourse, or do you just have to accept what it is that they're willing to say?
Well, I think more than people understand, a lot of times a lawyer has to accept what somebody's willing to say under oath. But sometimes we have other ways of proving contrary facts. Mm. What I will say, too, is that people's memories are affected by a lot of different things. So I'm always hesitant to call somebody a liar or say they're not telling the truth, because you know, a lot of times I'm asking about things that happened 18 months ago.
Right.
A lot of times everybody's got a particular perspective on things, and they might go up to meet their maker with a hand on a stack of Bibles and say, this is absolutely the truth, despite other objective facts saying otherwise,
you know,
just because of their personal perspective. So,
And,
you know, I've deposed what has to be hundreds of people, if not over 1,000 over the course of my career. And you see all kinds of people and all kinds of memories and perspectives on things, which are very interesting. So that, of course, is no different here. And it's also an exercise in why it would be useful if people talk to each other a little more often with an open mind. You know, if you can think about it, a lot of the players in some of the events over the past 2 years definitely would not voluntarily talk to me. But, you know, a deposition subpoena is not an invitation. It's a command. So they have to talk to me.
Yeah.
And it is interesting how my perspective changes a bit on them or doesn't. The longer I'm deposing them, and of course, a deposition is not a conversation either, but it's the most face-to-face communication I've had with some of the players in this, and the most communication, face-to-face communication they've had with me.
Right, right.
You know, when we talk on the breaks, exchange pleasantries on the breaks, or do other things, it is an interesting exercise in seeing each other face-to-face.
A little
surreal.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Where does former Ottawa County Administrator John Gibbs fall into all of this?
Well, that is an interesting question. So he is a witness under deposition subpoena in the Kleinyans case. Again, this was sort of at the tail end of his tenure that this stuff happened.
Right.
We know, for example, that he was the one that executed the direction to take consideration of MSU's memorandum of agreement, the contract extension, off the agenda. And he was involved to some extent, but not, I would say, deeply involved in the communications with the MSU officials, because that was sort of the beginning of the end of his.
Right.
Got it.
But then John Anderson came in, so I'm sure that he's probably entering the chat somewhere along the line too, right?
He's actually already been deposed.
Okay.
Mr. Gibbs is yet to come, but so it's interesting to get to ask some of these questions of some of these officials.
Well, since Gibbs is in Washington, D.C., how does that work logistically?
So funny you should ask that. You don't often, in my cases, get witnesses that are no longer living, at least in Michigan. We can't compel a witness to come any further than 100 miles.
Oh, interesting.
So, I didn't know that.
Yes. So what happens in that situation is I can go to them. I still have to subpoena them, serve them with a subpoena if they won't accept the subpoena. And I can go to them. So in the case of Mr. Gibbs, we had him served with a subpoena in D.C. And to depose him, the deposition must take place in D.C. unless he's willing to travel to Michigan, which I get why he's not. And so we will have a court reporter in D.C. It used to be all the lawyers would travel there. Now with Zoom, and usually such a deposition's conducted virtually where the lawyers are back in Michigan and only the court reporters there were the witness.
Got it.
Shoot, I thought I think that Washington's lovely this time of year.
Well, I was actually planning to go in person, and I might still. But you know, hard to say what will happen. We're still making those arrangements.
Okay.
But, so
now explain a little bit about deposition testimony and whether or not that is a matter of public record, where, because I honestly think people are very eager to see the outcome of these lawsuits, but they also kind of want to know sort of behind the scenes what people were willing to say about a lot of different things that aren't necessarily directly about the lawsuits, right? A lot of people want to know what happened over the last 2 years. So is that ever going to be a part of the public record?
I suspect it will. So one thing depositions are used for is supporting evidence in motions that come after the evidence collecting portion of things is over. And so we have to attach copies of deposition transcripts to those to prove that this person said this thing and it's evidence of whatever particular fact. So I know that will be the case here, or at least I suspect as much if the case doesn't settle for some reason before then. And that's one avenue where you often find deposition transcripts in the public record, because those are,
because I basically want to know where to look for what I'm looking for.
I mean, the other thing I would say is that deposition transcripts, there's nothing secret or sacred about deposition transcripts. If attorneys in the case want to release them and there's no contrary order from the court saying for some reason you can't, attorneys can release them. So they're a court proceeding, even though they don't occur in the public, right? Like, the public's not invited to attend these.
Right.
The only people who can attend a deposition are parties to the case. So while the public couldn't come to a deposition, if I wish to release a deposition transcript, so long as I wasn't releasing anything that was under a protective order.
I see.
So, for example, if somebody testifies about a medical condition, that's a thing. Usually it's a no-brainer to agree to a protective order. Like, right. We're going to not put some information about somebody's medical condition.
Right, HIPAA and all that, yeah.
And so usually there's, in any given case, there's usually like one or two facts that the fact itself we would agree, okay, that's going to be under
protective order. Right, so then order. Would that be redacted then?
Redacted,
okay.
Yeah, or, you know, you get the CIA black
stripes. Yeah, mm-hmm. yep.
So I suspect that will be the case here at some point, that these will get released, even if they're not part of a court file, with some of those relatively small pieces redacted out before the transcripts hit the public record. But we've seen locally, and when I say locally, I really mean broader West Michigan, you've seen examples of other transcripts being released in cases where the public was greatly interested in them. I would point you to the Founders case a few years ago, where they had an employee suing for discrimination, and those transcripts were released, and to great embarrassment for Founders.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be released. There's nothing sacred about them, so long as they're not covered by protective order.
Well, speaking of sacred releases, awkward pivot over to the Zimmer case, because is really that's the third and final lawsuit, and what you and the plaintiff Dan Zimmer proposed to the County Board of Commissioners was to release the minutes of a closed session where there in December of last year, where they subsequently approved severance agreements for former County Interim Administrator Ben Wetmore and Executive Aide Jordan Epperson. So where are we at in that case?
So here's where we are in that case. We proposed, this one has taken a very circuitous path, as I'm sure you know. We initially filed on behalf of Mr. Zimmer, challenging the under the Open Meetings Act, both their decision to go into closed session twice, first time.
Meaning they didn't cite a legal exemption, an applicable legal exemption to go into closed session,
correct. They read from the statute and said, we're going in to discuss, I think, the personnel matters pertaining to Wetmore and Epperson. And we said, look, you can tell from all surrounding facts that cannot possibly be the case. But they went into closed session. They had a discussion. We don't know what occurred. And then they came back out and announced they had approved very lucrative severance agreements for Mr. Wetmore and Mr. Epperson, who were still working at the county. You know, that's not usually how a severance agreement goes as someone who's in this business. So, but in any event.
Yeah, it was a super friendly one, because I think Commissioner Moss actually at the end, afterward, went to his social media and wrote about how amazing they were as employees.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So again, not your typical situation for a severance agreement.
No.
As someone who negotiates these for clients regularly, you don't get that situation every day. So the other thing, of course, Mr. Zimmer challenged was the process for and the legality of passing the contract to provide funds to the Crockery Lake project.
Mm-hmm.
And those occurred all in the same time vicinity, as you will recall. And then once we filed the lawsuit on behalf of Mr. Zimmer, the county commission tried again to reenact, as it's called under OMA.
Right.
In the event that they had violated OMA, the statute gives the commission the right to attempt to reenact the decision in order to undo the illegality.
Right.
To fix it.
And appropriately ratify those two severance agreements. The problem is they have to appropriately pass it again. They have to reenact it in a way that is legal. And here what they did is they said, we are going to pass again what we did before for reasons we're not allowing anybody to talk about. And again, there's the problem. They're not reenacting the decision in public, so you can see what was discussed. When other commissioners tried to discuss what had happened, they were shut down and not allowed to speak. So our position is, look, number two failed under the law as well. So you violated OMA twice.
Wow.
You never legally enacted it. It's not valid. These are not valid contracts.
Okay.
So, then we have the changing of the guard in January when the new commission takes place. And now we have a new majority. And now the new commission majority has decided we need to take a look at the second look at the Crockery Lake contract, because now we have some concerns that there's some illegality. And our position was, look, if they're going to take that up on their own and ask the judge for exactly what we'd be asking the judge for, better for them to do it than for us to do it.
Right.
So we dropped that claim from our case because they were going to do it.
Right.
So it was a very sort of, you know, I've never liked this expression, but gentleman's agreement, where we know they're going to add it, so we're just going to drop out that particular claim. Then so we are full and free concentration on these severance agreements for Mr. Epperson and Mr. Wetmore. And as you will recall, one of the things we did before the commission changed hands was try to get a court to come in and enjoin the county from paying out these contracts.
Right.
Because we felt like, look, they're illegal and there's irreparable harm that's going to be done to the county, in that it's very hard to unring this bell if these contracts are executed and paid out and these employees resign because they're being paid out. How do you undo that?
Right, because then they're going to sue and say, well, you know, we acted in good faith because we had an agreement.
We relied on the fact that we were being paid. So we said, look, you can't undo these contracts once they've been executed. You should stop them. The court did not agree with us, wouldn't stop them. And so the contracts have been executed. The fact remains, though, that we're still in this litigation. We're asking the court for relief, which includes saying there was an OMA violation, releasing the closed session minutes and the recording of the meeting, paying attorney's fees and the very small amount that goes to the plaintiff, up to $500 per violation. And then also ordering the unwinding of these contracts, so ordering that the county get its money back, that all the terms be undone.
Right.
Really?
Yes. And so,
well, you got to go for the gold, you know.
Right. I mean, that's the
you got to ask for all of it, and then, I mean, a lot of things can happen on the way to the you know, how it ends. But you got to ask for everything that you want.
So fast forward to the settlement discussion, and we said, look, county, here's what we really want. We think that that's what's best for you. Also, this should be mutually beneficial. Like, let's stop this now. We think we're right on the law, and we're eventually going to win, whether that's at the trial court, whether it's going to the Court of Appeals or later. And I said, look, you know, if Mr. Zimmer loses at the trial court, I think this is a very important issue, and I'm going to take it to the Court of Appeals. As my mother used to say, that is not a threat, it's a promise, right? So, like, so this
you got a snort out of me.
This is going farther if you win here. This is not over if you win here. And that's attorney's fees, and under OMA, I get attorney's fees if I win eventually. So there's that. And all that's going to happen to the county is that these minutes and the recording is going to get released if the judge agrees that this was an OMA violation. And we want those released.
I'd like to hear that audio.
Yeah, because if they did not go into closed session for legally appropriate reasons, then it wasn't a closed session is what that means.
I got it.
It should be.
And they had a quorum, so then they would have to release it under the OMA.
Yes, they would.
So, and that's what, again, if we win, that's a thing that gets ordered. Declare that you violated the OMA, which is nothing more than it sounds, and pay the attorney's fees at that point. Like, we'll cut off now, pay the attorney's fees at this point. And, you mean, initially the reaction of the lawyer for the county was, who, again, I have great respect for, I've known for years, I've had multiple other cases with him besides this one, says, well, why would I do that? That's everything you want. And I said, well, it's not everything we want. What we really wanted was for these contracts to be stopped
right.
and unwound, and we'll give up. We'll agree, like, look, we're not going to go after that. We're just going to stop now. Like,
it's sort of the principle of the thing.
Right. I get it. Okay.
We will agree that we've won on principle. We've made our point. Like, this shouldn't have happened. It was an OMA violation. And now the public will get to hear how the decision got made and have that information. And we'll all pack up and go home, right?
Got it.
If we're still fighting about this a year and a half from now, I guarantee you the attorney's fees are going to be giant compared to what they are now. So that is a giant benefit.
Bigger the court, bigger the cost.
Oh, boy.
A benefit, in our view, to both the county and to us. Like, this is serves all sides. So far they have not, as you know, so far they have not taken up the question of considering our offer, which is their right. Mm-hmm. So, as was our right, we subpoenaed to get a copy of those closed session minutes and the recording. So our argument is we're entitled to that information and discovery because we can't conclusively prove without it that we're right. Mm-hmm. So far, all we have is inference that they did not go into closed session for a proper purpose and for the purpose that they said they were going to into closed session. Plus, we have a couple of other commissioners saying in public that that's not why they were running closed session. So, you know, I think that's pretty good inferential evidence. But we're in our view is we're entitled in discovery to having that information. The statute says you can't release it to the public without a court order. And my position is I'm not the public. I'm an officer of the court as an attorney, and I'm entitled, while that's definitely discovery I can't put out into the public record until I get a court order otherwise, I'm entitled to hear it and be able to argue to the judge, like, look, I'm absolutely right. Listen to this recording. Mm-hmm. I should win.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, this proves I am correct. And they can't keep it hidden and say, well, she can't prove she's correct.
Right.
By saying you get to stay hidden.
So going back to the FOIA deposition, so she was explaining about how, you know, the depositions are a matter of public record unless there is an order. So what she essentially was offering was to voluntarily enter into such a protective order so that the county couldn't say, well, we can't possibly give this to you because we can't release them. She's saying as an officer of the court, she would uphold that ethical boundary to not, it wouldn't go beyond her eyes or ears, so to speak.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as I expected, they have gone to the judge, filed what's called a motion to quash, and said, you know, we should not have to comply with this. There is no court order. She's asking for them to be released, and we think that's illegal, so that we can argue about that legal issue and get the judge to decide it one way or the other. And so that is a hearing that will be held in early June in front of the judge that this case is in front of.
Okay.
Yeah, and my reporting around the time that this was approved, it was after the injunction, the motion to file for the TRO was filed. I talked to a couple of the commissioners that were not in the majority and basically said, you know, what the heck happened in these meetings? You know, what went down? And it's interesting when you bring up how memories can be affected, because it had not been that long. It had only been like a matter of a few days. And I'm talking to four different people who were in the exact same meeting, and they all had slightly different accounts, or, you know, one person definitely remembers this, but isn't quite sure on this detail. The other person definitely remembers this detail, but doesn't recall ever talking about this, because depending on what they were invested in, interested in, emotional about. And I remember saying to whoever was last on the line, I don't even remember the order that I talked to them in. I just said, you were all in the same space, and it was for like, you know, a half an hour. How do you not remember what happened? So I think it's kind of wild. But that, you know, they all agreed that there was some seriously controversial conversation during that, the closed session in particular with Jordan Epperson, and that he, that Joe Moss presented to the commissioners that there was a potential legal claim that Epperson had against the county. And
What was that all about?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you which person told me it, but I can tell you what they told me, because they all confirmed that this is essentially what happened. The allegation was that Epperson claims that county HR released sensitive information, personal information. I don't know exactly what that was, whether it was his address, whether it was his phone number.
Mm-hmm.
And that they released the information to me, which I found fascinating because I had no idea what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I can think of is that when he was first hired and publicly, John Gibbs, who is then the administrator, refused. He acknowledged that he had hired an executive aide, but refused to identify him.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which was very strange.
Very odd.
So we went digging because, you know, that's the worst thing to do to journalists, because now they're like, well, what's going on?
I'm not going to tell you.
Well, yeah, now I'm a dog with a bone. So we ended up finding we ended up confirming through lots of different channels, but we ended up FOIA'd for all of the people who applied for the job. Now, you might remember that this yielded many resumes, And this also identified a second finalist that was considered, who was Ryan Kimball, who ended up yes. ultimately suing the county for age discrimination and, you know, was successful.
Yeah.
And so when we published the story identifying Jordan Epperson, that's the only time that I recall ever even being in proximity to his personal information. But when I got his resume through the FOIA process, through the county, mm-hmm. all of that information was redacted. So the claim in this meeting was that because of whatever was released to me, uh-huh. allegedly, uh-huh. That he got doxxed and that the county violated his rights in some way. And so it was a little bit loosey-goosey. The commissioners told me that Moss was reading from a piece of paper that purportedly was from a local attorney who had reviewed the potential liability to the county with mm-hmm. the Epperson claim. After all of this happens, there are some questions about whether or not that local attorney actually did any of that review. And according to these same commissioners who were in that meeting, they have subsequently said that that this local attorney denies ever having done that. So now there are questions about whether or not there was misrepresentation from board leadership before these, particularly this agreement was approved.
Okay.
rendered Mary Ellen speechless.
I don't put my address on my resume anymore.
Welcome to Ottawa County.
I don't put my address on my resume anymore. You don't need to know where I live.
Yeah, I mean,
why do you need to know where I live for a job I'm applying? You don't need to know where I live.
I mean, I think I still have mine on there.
No,
but I mean, I have filed so many FOIAs for candidates for lots of different, you know, superintendents and city manager candidates, all that stuff. And it is common practice to redact their phone number, their email,
right,
and their address.
Right.
I mean, and even if it's on there, I'll usually block it out myself mm-hmm. if a FOIA coordinator missed it, because mm-hmm. I don't want anybody giving me nasty phone calls.
There you go.
But one of the things that I said to the commissioners as they're kind of recapping this whole story to me is that, wait a minute, you guys, like the story's still up with his resume fully redacted appropriately mm-hmm. online mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you take your phone and double check that what you were being told was true? And they said, well, I didn't really think of that. You know, this is Sarah. It's like being in a pressure cooker when you're in closed session. I remember one of them telling me that. And I just thought, but this is so easily verifiable.
To be fair, I mean, shouldn't you be able to assume that someone's telling you the truth in that
true.
Situation?
That's
that is,
true.
I know. I guess like the journalist in me is like, well, because I was, you know, part of this weird narrative that's mm-hmm. going on behind closed doors, mm-hmm. having no idea that that was happening when I'm watching this meeting. And one of the other things that I found fascinating is that they approved these agreements in the exact same manner that they approved the $4 million settlement with Adeline Hambly. Mm-hmm. And they have been told in the Hambly case, a judge did rule that they basically said motion to approve to accept legal counsel's recommendation in the case of Adeline Hambly in Ottawa County. Well, under OMA, you have to say what you're voting on. You have to give some additional detail. Yeah.
Okay.
Or it's invalid, which the judge ultimately ruled later, months later, and said this was too vague.
Super infuriating to watch that after. I was like, I mean, gentlemen, we just went over this.
Yes.
Right.
And then they reenacted
detail.
Then they reenacted a second time and did the same thing. And I'm like, oh my, what are we doing? that was just bizarre. I don't understand how that lesson did not carry forward, because
well, yeah, if you're was there some initial reluctance to tell us what the terms of the
exactly
more
exactly
contracts were, although I guess you did find out pretty quickly what was in them.
Well, I mean, and that's I think one thing that the readership, listenership, what have you, should know is that when you have an ultra majority that is controlling, dictating a lot of the ways that things are happening, mm-hmm.
if you're like completely silencing the rest of the members on the board, by that time they were sort of over it and they had had enough. And so they're finding any ways, they were going to social media and releasing a lot of these details. Mm-hmm. They weren't just giving things to me anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, they sort of got a little bit more comfortable saying, okay, well, I guess this is just the way that it works, in order to get any information out there that I think people need to know about.
Mm-hmm. And are entitled to know about.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, it's been fascinating to see that.
Wow.
Also, I just want to go on the record to say that people can talk about what happened in closed sessions. There's nothing under the statute that says that you are not allowed to discuss what happened in a closed session. There's case law that says that, you know, commissioners can testify about what happened in closed session and lawsuits. I mean, we've even had that in the Hambly case. There was testimony taken from the county clerk, Justin Roebuck, mm-hmm. about what happened in that closed session.
Right, right, right.
You know, I had helped the Sentinel initiate the lawsuit to release those minutes, and that litigation is still ongoing. The Sentinel's still pursuing that, and I think that they'll win. But releasing closed session minutes is something that is addressed in the statute, but discussing it is not. And so when you see the county lawyer, you know, repeatedly over and over again for like 2 years, and the board leadership kind of shouting down the commissioners who want to talk about what happened, mm-hmm. They're saying, you're violating OMA, you're violating OMA. No, they're not. No, they're not. There's nothing in the statute that addresses that.
Wow. I have learned a lot.
It's just that one bothered me greatly, because I would be like shouting at my computer going, that's not what the law says.
Wow. I've learned a lot in the last hour here, and I was gonna tackle national news. We'll save that for another time. I would love a lawyer's perspective.
We had a lot to unpack today.
Yeah, on what's been happening on a national level. Wow, Sarah Riley Howard, thank you so much for being here. This has been amazing.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Isn't it nice to have it like straight from the? I mean, because when I interview her for her the various stuff, it's always through like my filter, right?
I get it.
And you just get components of what she's saying, but it's really interesting to hear from her directly, like how the process works.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, I don't need a lawyer right now, but if I ever do.
You know a guy.
The lady who sued the county.
That's right. Many times.
This has been a special edition of 2 J's in a Pod. Wow. Thanks for being here, everybody.